Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Thank you, Brian Brown. It is Tuesday, May 26th, 2020, in the year of the tweet and the global pandemic. With me this morning in the Gene Boss studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon, while the rest of our team lounges comfortably at home in their PJs, zooming into the show is our master of the virtual mix and Zoom modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm still here. And it's still working, all the buttons.
Really? Yeah, and there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them this morning.
Seems like we're busier now than we were before.
Boy, no question. No question.
And having returned from cataract surgery is Lynn Carrigan, who came to us out of the land of magnolias and settled here on the island of Madrones, is our analytic, academic, social worker, poet, backup singer, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes. So, did surgery improve your insights, Lynn?
Oh, wait. Well, Lynn, we're not hearing you. You're muted. You're muted.
My insights, I don't know. No, I just unmuted. I'm good. Takes a delay. Thank you. I will say that rather than now being able to go by Blind Mango Carrigan, I am not yet blind Mango Carrigan.
Good.
That's good to know.
Thing. That's a good thing.
But there goes your blues.
Blues name. Yeah. I know.
Oh, gosh. I've got to come up with something new. Bruce Hallman is our stalwart guardian of the galaxy, and as an historian, he attempts to provide a long-range view and continually reminds us that while the grinding wheels of justice...
They're there.
Good, Lynn.
Sounds like a gigantic belch. While the grinding wheels of justice may take time, they eventually get the bastards in the end. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Good to be here. I at times wonder whether the bastards will ever be gotten, but I keep trying to keep my faith that they will in the end. So we'll see.
Yeah, you're there to help us.
Lock them up.
Yeah.
Ring in my ears.
Amen.
Joining us for a second delightful week off the bench from his self-distancing semi-retirement is singer, thespian, landscape architect, tech, half a bubble short of plum carpenter Michael Shook, a.k.a. Chauncey Gardner. So glad to have your pith and wit back with us, Michael. Good morning.
You are too kind. Thank you. It's good to be back. It's fun to see you guys. I feel badly for our listener because our listener cannot see all these wonderful faces. But this is great. So thank you.
But Michael, I hate to tell you this, but they couldn't see us before either.
Okay.
I was going to mention
that.
I didn't want to burst. We've never introduced you as a techno expert.
That's right.
Often our expert, our
also zooming in to enlighten us today is political pundit extraordinaire and editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly publication. For your consideration, he is Kevin Jones. Kevin, what's Indivisible doing about?
Shout out for so many folks on Vachon. There were, I think, upwards of 30. Collected together to we're on board. But there was a call out for 1,000 postcards to go out to Georgia, whose primary has been moved twice because of the virus and will now occur, we hope, cross our fingers, on next Tuesday, June 9th. So we wanted to make sure to let voters in Georgia, who is a significantly voter-suppressed state, know about the schedule change and that it's so important for them to vote. So that is just one of many things that Indivisible Vashon, in conjunction with Vashon Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE, with Jessica Lisovsky, is all about. So I'm glad we're still active.
Me too.
Yes.
And I am Susan McCabe, here to fulfill my duty of providing insightful feminist critiques of the actions of our reigning big chief Little Hands right before I host VOV's Real Talk, which follows the Briefly by 15 minutes. Please stay tuned, folks, after the Briefly, when I will talk with steady state economist Dr. Brian Check about what he sees as the silver lining in the pandemic.
So, Susan, did you interview him once before?
This is his third visit.
Yeah. I remember hearing him.
He's got some really interesting insights.
Yeah.
And this time, I think, as I put before, he's going to tip over a few sacred cows that might even excite some of the liberals among us.
Oh.
So,
wow. Interesting. We will listen to that.
His view could be considered avant-garde or perhaps twisted.
Susan, I have a comment about Big Hands Little Chief that occurred to me when you were talking with Bruce in the intro. There was some discussion about whether or not when Trump loses in 2020, November of this year, whether he's going to run again in 2024. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If he loses the election now, he's going to be in jail, right, because of all the crimes he's committed.
We could hope.
Can you run as president if you're in jail? I haven't looked that up.
I think you can.
Probably.
There was the fellow, oh, goodness, I'm blanking on his name.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
The leader of a sort of a quasi-libertarian group. Running independently, and he was, I think he was in jail for fraud, and he actually filed papers and ran for office.
Really? Well, he can't vote.
Maybe the nature of the crime will allow you to run, and we'll see what happens with 45.
Yeah, well, he's also, since he's not wearing a mask, at high risk of getting COVID-19. That would be our...
We are trying to zip it right now. Comment,
I know, there's a
that.
Whole lot of...
I saw a whole bunch of people gritting their teeth.
A lot of chewing on the inside of cheeks going on. Uh-huh.
I'm encouraged by Sarah, our priest, to be a good Christian and you know, love my neighbor, love everyone. I can say that it is an extraordinary challenge some days. So I go ahead and let the thoughts go, and then I say, okay, forgive me for thinking that.
See, that's a great thing about the Christian religion. You can always be forgiven for those evil thoughts you've had.
Well, it's true with Buddhism, too. If
and
you're
on
meditating.
The other hand, you know, Trump questions whether or not Nancy Pelosi prays for him, you know, and calls her a liar for saying so. But actually, in the Episcopal Church, we always pray for our leaders, starting with the president. And one of the things that one of the ways I get through that is thinking I can easily pray for peace and compassion and, you know, the good of the world when I'm praying for him and praying for him to gain some enlightenment somewhere. It's not that I hold out much hope for that. And I'm praying for the country, really. But, you know, he has an office that needs to be honored, and he needs to honor it. And that's what we're praying about.
I don't know, when you say you're praying for leaders, whether he actually qualifies. However,
good point.
Moving right along.
You always have to remember Saul on the road to Damascus in a blinding light, and he changed dramatically. So anything's possible.
That's right.
Okay. See, Bruce, you are here to help us maintain our hope. Kevin?
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was thinking about our leader, and particularly today, and particularly with the song that Truman and Molly ended their show with as we were coming on board, and regarding the number of fatalities from the virus, which today, probably around sometime around 5 o'clock today, we will cross the threshold of 100,000 Americans who've now perished as a consequence of our country's the worst handling of the virus on the globe.
Indeed, and reports are indicating that it's probably much higher than 100,000, closer to 130,000, because we didn't even start counting until, what, January, February? Bruce?
Right. Yep. February, I think.
And there's no recognition of this. I mean, you look at, 50,000 deaths in Vietnam and a memorial on the mall. And, I mean, it's just amazing that our national leadership and Democrats in Congress included in that. Nobody is looking at these milestones as we pass them and making any really real mention of them. It's up to the press to remind us that the numbers continuing to count. And that's unfortunate, particularly on this Memorial Day weekend, yesterday a day of remembrance, and very little done to recognize the 100,000 plus who've died as a result of incompetence on the part of national leaders.
Yeah,
I wish that he would understand and work with his government, which he has gutted, about the role of the administration to comfort the people, all the people, not just his people, and to agree to be the national kind of face of the coordination of the public health and the government and the economic train that we're all riding on. It is a sad thing, and I've been gone from it for a week. And let me tell you, my whole body, during the midst of all this stress, finally started relaxing, and I realized it was because I was not listening to traumatic news every second. Everything wrong all the time.
All the time.
And my feeling now is that all outrage all the time is not sustainable or healthy. Mm. And as the election heads closer, that we need to work more closely with our alliance partners and our independents to get that vote out, which he continues to try to suppress. Mm-hmm. That's my focus now.
There is a little hope. I think Joseph O'Neill wrote in the New York Review of Books that it might be time to announce the end of the Republican Party, or at least branding them anything other than a group of people intent on gaining and keeping power by whatever means possible. It appears there are some Republicans who want to correct the party's course. They are members of what is called the Lincoln Project, and they state their mission as to defeat President Trump and Trumpism at the ballot box. And they're even willing to vote for some Democrats in order to do that. And Truman, I think you pulled up their website.
Yeah.
There's more to the mission.
Do you want the rest of the mission statement?
Sure.
We do not undertake this task lightly, nor form ideological preference. Our main policy differences with national Democrats remain. However, the priority for all patriotic Americans must be a shared fidelity to the Constitution and a commitment to defeat those candidates who have abandoned their constitutional oaths, regardless of party. Electing Democrats who support the Constitution over Republicans who do not is a worthy effort.
Pretty exciting. However, I did notice on the roster of people who are involved, there are former political pundits and law firm folks, all of which are pretty powerful people. None of them hold public office in the Senate, the House, or anywhere else for that matter.
Susan, are you saying that none of the current legislature has broken with the party and, signed on to that Lincoln Project?
Not openly.
Well, what I'm looking at here, Susan, is that this says advisors. It doesn't say anything about members, and the advisors are the ones who are not.
Good point.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are a number of legislators that are on this with this group
who might be listening to those advisors.
Yeah.
It would be nice. So, what do you all think about that? How do you see that? Does it bode
it's
hope?
About time someone started calling the party out on its horrible record. We've talked about this before in years past. This kind of the kind of politics that the GOP has been practicing, and I'm not exonerating Democrats. They do plenty of awful things at different times, but it seems like with the advent of the Newt Gingrich area, it became scorched earth. We're just taking compromise out of the equation, and that has led to somebody like Steve Bannon having the level of power that he has. And frankly, I think that guy is a maniac. He's like Robespierre in the French Revolution, who just decided if we have to destroy everything, and he has said that, Bannon has said that, we have to first destroy this entire system, and then we'll put it back together again the way that it, quote, should be. That's an extraordinarily dangerous and foolish way to approach governing.
And it's not just Bannon, though, Michael, because they have very pointedly been going after, judges, Supreme mm-hmm. Court judges, mm-hmm. other justices, seating other legislators, funding Heritage Foundation and all kind of very conservative think tanks to figure out how to infiltrate and change the mind of education out of liberal values towards more conservative values. So, it has been a concentrated attack by many people.
And I just one more thing, Kevin, and I would say not truly conservative, because I think true conservatives understand that that there are things worth conserving that are really important to all of us in a nation and outside of our nation. And I see what's happening now, like with people like Mitch McConnell as the Senate Majority Leader. He's not a conservative. He's just power crazed.
Fascist.
And would do anything to hold on to it. That's not conservatism.
Well, I agree.
Let me suggest that what we're seeing a revolution.
Yes.
A revolution destroys the old system and replaces it with the new system. And so those of us who want to preserve the old system are the conservatives. The ones who want to get rid of the old system are revolutionaries.
And I agree.
That's the nature of a revolution, you have to decide which side of the revolution you want to be on. Kevin?
No, it's interesting, this discussion about conservation, because there's a group known as Washington Conservation Voters. And I had to carefully explain in endorsing them that they are for environmental causes and conserving what we have. But now our language becomes disturbed, right? When we think about conservatives it's those people on the right. One of the things that the Lincoln group did is they produced an advertisement called Morning in America. It's MOURNING.
Mm.
It got quite a bit of airplay. It's worth looking at if you haven't seen it. But the thing that was intriguing to me is that subsequent to that, we saw a lot of demonstrations with people leaving body bags right on the White House, near the White House gate and at state capitals, particularly in states that are open. We elect these people to govern our country and to take care of us. And where we see this great disparity between actions and the charter that we give them, we need to rise up and call that out. And I think that that's happening. And I'm really happy the Lincoln Project is making progress on that.
So one of the things that's always disturbed me about the cleaning house that's going on is the fact that we're losing this, our institutional knowledge. And that's one of the problems with term limits and all of those things, is that I understand wanting to, you know, completely change, as you were pointing out, Bruce. I mean, that's part of their mentality. But at the same time, you need to have some folks in there who knows how the darn thing works. You know, I mean, what's going to keep the government going? You have to have some of that institutional knowledge. And if you wipe it all out, now you're starting from scratch. And that's nuts. You know, Kevin.
Yeah, true. I've never bought into this notion that let's blow it up and it'll somehow become better as a consequence. And that's not limited to folks who are, you know, in some of these factions that we've been discussing. That sometimes is true of people who are not willing to support some of the primary candidates from the primary parties, because, you know, if we have enough people who don't vote for them, they'll listen to us and change. Right. Unfortunately, a couple hundred years of our democracy has shown that that's actually not true at all. Parties came on pretty darn quick, and they've been extremely durable. So I think it's important to realize that we do need to make changes, but the notion of blowing everything up or, you know, throwing everybody out is probably not really the path.
Right. Lynn?
I heard the interview this morning on NPR with Steve Earle, the folk singer, and it was such a good interview. He has just released a new album. I'm not exactly remembering the name of it, but he's focusing on coal miners. Some of the songs he's singing are targeted really towards the people in the mines and the people doing these very difficult jobs. Very hazardous. And what he was saying struck a big note with me. He said that when the coal companies wanted to continue after busting the unions that were fought for with people's lives during the first part of the 20th century, trying to get adequate pay and adequate safety regulations and adequate, you know, protections under those conditions, that most of those companies have busted all that union protection, but they continue to pay people really highly. And what Steve Earle, who is living in Nashville, I think, says is that people vote their pocketbook and they are getting paid well to ignore their safety and their health and many other corporate issues. And he said, we've got to find a way to find common ground with those people and think about whatever rebuilding is going to happen takes into account people with low wages, like we're seeing with our essential workers and all these people who cannot work from home or remotely, and they're in dangerous positions every day. So to me, if I think of where is the issues and common ground beyond the craziness in the Senate and executive office, I think we still have much work to do to figure out with everybody that is influential and how much people get paid to try to get protections and safety and government regulations which protect people balanced with corporate profits and corporate interests. We just haven't figured out a way to do it.
Yeah, I was going to say, having worked for a non-union company and a union company, I can tell you that in the airline industry, anyway, I've said this before, all of the safety regulations, the time limits for, you know, duty time limits and those kinds of things, all came about from the unions.
That's right.
And in fact, if you look at a checklist from just a regular checklist out of an airplane, you can go through there and I can mark every one of those things in there that was brought about. Changes that were made due to the influence of a union. Safety changes.
That's right.
Very interesting. By the way, the name of the album that you were wondering is Ghost of West Virginia.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, true. Mm-hmm.
So, Lynn, are you promoting the notion of rebuilding unions with this idea?
I am, and have been for a long time. As a social work professor, I was the liaison to many of the unions that have social workers as organizers. you know, really working on public policy from the ground swell up takes a long time. You know, it's thinking in the time of trees. It's building coalitions and understanding and alliances and seeing, you know, who's able to take the risk of going on the picket line, which is what people hate. They're vilified for, you know, and how, I don't know what they're doing right now to kind of meet the issues that are coming up in these times where essential workers who are being basically forced to go to work and people return to employment, but unsafely. If they want money, they have to go work in unsafe conditions.
I was going to throw one more thing out there. We talk about Social Security and we talk about retirements and all of those things. One of the things that the, I think it was the railroads that put together was the retirement programs for all of the railroads have, it's the union. The union is the one who has the retirement program, not the individual That's companies. Right. And when I first heard that, I thought, what? Well, that doesn't make any sense. But if you look at the, like for the, I'm most familiar with the airlines, of course, if you look at the airline industry, if the union had taken on the retirement program where people are paying into their retirements to the union rather than to the individual company, if those companies go out of business, their retirement is still saved. Or if they happen to change companies, which is kind of rare in the airline industry, but their retirement didn't change. I mean, they keep contributing to the same program. So I've often thought, boy, that would be, you know, there are a number of industries where that could be a real solution.
That's a good point, Truman. The Carpenters Union followed a thing like that, but it takes time and a really dedicated effort to build that up. But eventually, the Carpenters Union got to a point where they had enough members, enough work that they were able to not only set up their own pension fund, but they also were able to set up their own medical fund.
Right.
So and the electrical workers union and the laborers union has done the same thing. And the laborers union, man, those guys have a health package that most people would just like, are you kidding me? Yeah. They love that. Yeah, so it's a good way to go. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what'd you...
Well, I was just going to follow in to that. I have an uncle in Virginia who's in his 70s, this is a decade ago now, had to go back to work because the company that he worked for and the pension that he worked for years and decades did go away. And so now he had to go work as a security officer in a poultry factory, work in the night shift in his 70s. So these are the consequences. The really dire situation is as states decide that they're going to reopen and people can risk their lives now for our economy or for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, people now lose the ability to collect unemployment compensation. And so as Lynn pointed out, you know, they really have to make life and death decisions about food on the table versus getting sick, which is really an atrocious position to put people in.
All for meat in the economy. Lynn?
Follow up on.
I would just, you know, kind of add to this the challenges that the unions had, you know, in the late 50s and 60s were that they were making piles of money for themselves up at the top, you know, the Hoffa era where there was a lot of mob involvement and corruption involved in the union. And I think that for about 10 years, for those listeners who are younger, you know, you have not grown up in an era where unions weren't vilified by the corporations and sometimes by people who disliked having to pay into kind of a very corrupt, top-heavy structure. And, you know, that needs to change and has changed, you know, after a lot of investigation into that. And I guess I just want to say that the principle of having union representative for labor being able to negotiate with corporations to be able to work under fair conditions you know, that time will come back. You watch.
Well, I just want to throw out one quick thing, and that is that unions and management, if they work well together, it's a really a great system. If it's adversarial, it's a terrible system.
Right.
So
yeah,
that's right.
And I would, Lynn, that's a great point that you brought up. And I've had people say to me, "Oh, well, your carpenters union, boy, I bet those guys are corrupt and everything." And they actually are not. We've had our struggles down through the years, but it reminds me of how this is just what it is to be human. And when we govern ourselves, and belonging to a union is participating in a little bit different form of governance, but you have a vote and everything, and deciding on contracts and representatives and all. And it's kind of that old thing of the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
That's exactly
just as
right.
Members have to keep an eye on the manager, you know, your team out there. So do we as citizens have to keep an eye on our representatives and our senators and our local legislatures and everything. And, you know, what are they doing? Because there's, whenever you get that kind of power, we all know that it gets very tempting to start funneling money here or there.
Kevin.
So that might be a segue into a comment that we had in our notes here today about Matt Shea, who is Eastern Washington legislator, who's known for stirring up domestic terrorism, actually. And one of the other stunts is that he was involved in one of the what a friend of mine calls the super spreader demonstrations, where people gather to argue that the country should economy should reopen, and therefore you know spread the virus even further. Matt Shea apparently was fined for dumping olive oil on the steps of the legislature building there in Olympia. But it turns out that since we now have filing week behind us, that apparently Matt decided that the domestic terrorist and legislative job descriptions don't really match up well, and so he has not filed to run for his seat in the 6th Congressional District. So for sure, Mr. Shea will not be part of our dialogue as a legislator in the future. Just wanted to point that out to folks.
Boy.
That sounds like a victory, maybe. But I couldn't get the image out of my mind of olive oil on the steps. What would that do?
That
just cause people to slip all over the place?
No, it stains it apparently and soaks into the marble. And so they have a disfigured marble staircase now. And I heard on the radio the amount it would cost to clean it, which, you know, I wanted to run down there with a spick and span and say, I'll do it for $100 less.
That was the fine. They billed Shea for the cleaning of it. It was $4,700. And I'm not sure exactly how that money was spent, but having worked around a lot of construction sites where we had marble tiles and, you know, marble bathrooms and marble countertops and things like that. Yeah, it's a real struggle to get stuff like that out of it. So, yeah, he was the scary thing about Matt Shea now is that on the one hand, we won't have him in the legislature anymore. Now he's out there doing I don't know what, you know, and this again goes back to where was the Republican Party on this? This is a person who was investigated, I think, judiciously and not in a biased manner. And the investigation came back and said this person has been fomenting forms of domestic terrorism. Where's the outrage on the part of Republicans in this state? It's crazy.
I guess as long as it benefits them, or the publicity and the sort of brouhaha doesn't directly affect them and their ability to pass their laws and their, you know, tax benefits and all that, I just think they are kowtowing and looking the other way and hoping to slide. And I hope, like we started talking about, the end of the Republican Party. If the Republican Party continues to act like a front for mob behavior, they should go down. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to what would be left. However, all this discussion about unions and the demise thereof and the hopeful return thereof and the letting loose of a Matt Shea kind of person just makes me think about how involved the media and the manipulation thereof have been in the demise of unions, for one. Corporations vilified them, and they went down a whole lot faster than they came up. And now a person like Matt Shea is free to be a media manipulator like the, what do you call him, the orange turd in the White House? Yeah.
T-Rump. I call him T-Rump.
T-Rump. That's great. And thank you, Michael, for introducing me to Heather Cox Richardson.
You're welcome. She's great.
She's fabulous. Wow. And her Letters from an American, if you want to check it out, folks, Heather Cox Richardson, she is right on. And she pointed out how Trump went to Twitter this weekend because he's running scared at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And just said some ridiculous things. But that's what he does. Mm-hmm. He manipulates the media, and the media does so much to set the tone. And then, of course, our beloved journalists follow him like ducklings.
They do. And I am just as angry. That's part of what I was saying when I was on kind of a forced media diet without all that, all COVID all the time and all Trump all the time. It was so much more healing. And I agree with you, Susan, that the media is, you know, based on fear. Fear sells papers. Fear is what people need to, you know, learn about what to be anxious about today. Trump's doing shock and awe, you know, journalism and leadership. He said from the day he got elected that he was going to day by day, you know, find something to vanquish. And he distracts. And that's how it is. And they all fall after him in a shameful way. I agree.
You are so right. And by the way, Randy Rainbow has done a great parody on tradition from, help me with the play.
Fiddler on the Roof.
Fiddler on the Roof.
Thank you. Called Distraction. But he is distracting us. Trump is distracting us from the horrible things that he's actually doing, like letting the post office go down in September, folks, before November, when we may have only vote by mail available to us. Hello. What are we doing about that?
Wow.
The media is not covering that. There are sinister and malevolent forces working right now. I do not know how this is all coalescing around this man, and they are letting him getting away with gutting things, you know, services and institutions that protect democracy.
Oversight.
Well, one of the things I'm really concerned about, folks, is that the election comes about. First of all, do we have the election? Are we able to actually do it? And secondly, if he does lose and says, no, I'm not going, it was a corrupt election and it wasn't valid, and I'm staying put. What do we do then?
I will march on Washington myself.
Well, it's an armed insurrection. I mean, what is it? You know?
Well, we're getting armed folks at, like in Michigan.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're pro-Trump guys.
Yeah.
This is a good topic to talk more about. Next week, we're drawing towards the end of the show, and I had this for last week. This is a non sequitur, but could you guys afford me this here?
Of course.
Sure.
So the 17th of this month was the birthday of a woman named Anna Jameson. I like this because this shows there's always been individuals in our history who have said, you know what? I'm supposed to do this. These are the expectations that have been made for me. But I'm going to follow my own path here, and I'm going to be something that nobody really expected me to be. And so this woman was born in the late 18th century. And in 1837, she became a travel writer and an adventurer and an explorer. 1837, so yeah. She's in a canoe trip going down the length of Lake Huron. And there's just, she writes beautifully here, and there's just, this is just an excerpt. She says, there were two birch bark canoes, each 5 and 20 feet in length and 4 feet in width, tapering to the two extremities and light, elegant, and buoyant as the sea mew when it skims the summer waves. My blankets and night gear being rolled up in a bundle served as a seat, and I had a pillow at my back, and thus I reclined in the bottom of the canoe as in a litter, very much at my ease. I had near me my cloak, umbrella, and parasol, must be prepared for rain and sun, notebooks and sketchbooks, and a little compact basket always by my side, containing eau de cologne, and all those necessaries which might be wanted in a moment. And I just, I love that, her style of writing and everything, and the chutzpah of this woman. I mean, that 1837 was pretty wild out here still.
Yeah.
And it made me think of I have a book that's a little over 100 years old now, by Rosita Forbes, who's another woman in the early 20th century who traveled all across North Africa. She was the first Western female to visit a mosque deep in the Arab countries where no Western woman had ever gone. She disguised herself and was a travel writer and an adventurer for years. And I mean, there are lists of people and of women like this who have always gone out and done things. And Margaret Mead, of course, saying, never underestimate the power of an individual. Lynn, what were you?
I was just going to say amen to that, and to say that that is exactly what we're going to rely on, is the ingenuity of women leadership as well as male leadership, a focus more on the family, a focus on doing the right thing.
My feminist heart is full.
I think we can be an adventurer and innovative in these times if we're not cowed by all the shock and awe.
Yes.
If you're outraged, Trump has won. If you're not outraged, Trump has won.
Absolutely.
So find the middle ground.
Amen to that. Thanks for listening.